Hi everyone, welcome back to another episode of Enablement Evolved. This one has been a long time coming. I did say on LinkedIn that I was going to take a short break after the birth of my son. I did think that was going to be a month. It's turned into 3.5 months, which is very interesting and probably unsurprising to anyone who's had a newborn. And this podcast is slightly different. So for the first time, I have two guests on the one episode, which is going to be we're going to make for a fantastic conversation, especially around the subject that we're talking about. So I follow both of these chaps on LinkedIn. I've spoken to one of them off and on for probably about 9 to 12 months. And then the other one, we just recently connected, but you'll all be very familiar. So I would like to introduce you to Lawrence Wayne and Jonathan Mahan of the Practice Lab. And then I'll hand over to each of you to give a little bit of a background, if you don't mind. So first, if I hand over to you, Lawrence, welcome to Enablement Evolved. Would you mind giving us a bit of a background on yourself?
Thank you, man. First of all, congratulations. That's big. So if you were to take a whole year off, like that's a big one. So congratulations on the newborn. Okay, so my story in enablement, I'm going to start early and then I'm going to jump into where it becomes specific to enablement. So for me, my background is in sports and music. Those have been my two main passions. I played basketball in college, grew up in Chicago in the 90s when the Bulls were winning all those championships. So Michael Jordan's my guy. He's my GOAT. And I played college basketball in Atlanta. So while I was there, really focused on business. That's what I studied. I met Mark Cuban while I was there. He came and spoke to our basketball team. And he said, if I were you, I would go and learn digital content right now. I would take all the business prerequisite classes and then go learn digital content. So that set me off on a journey that took me to a music studio. I interned at a recording studio for a while, loved music, didn't love the business side of it. And so that's what got me into sales. And I started working at Apple. I was a sales guy, always creating his own content. I worked at a couple startups in Atlanta. I was the marketing guy who worked very closely with sales and things like ABM, event marketing, demand gen, that kind of thing. And kind of the igniting event for me into enablement was I had been running some coaching sessions, and a friend of mine was a headmaster at a high school. And he said, hey, why don't you come and teach my high school kids entrepreneurship? Would you mind like running the entrepreneurship program for a year full time? And I said, sure. And the module that we had the toughest time with was sales. Obviously, if you're 17, you hardly ever speak on the phone. So when you have to get on the phone and actually tell people about what you're doing, it's pretty daunting. But by the end of that year, I was like, okay, if I can teach this to 17-year-olds, I think I can do this at businesses. So from there, I got really into sales enablement. I actually moved out to the UK and started consulting with sales companies, running 3-day trainings on Challenger Sale or Sandler or all of these methodologies. So I really enjoyed that, but what I didn't enjoy was talking to sellers 3 to 6 months later and realizing that the training was great, but we're not really using that anymore. And they'd move on to the next thing. So my idea was, let me go embed at a company full time and figure out this whole enablement thing and build out a company or a enablement function from scratch. So over the past about 15 or so months, I've been doing that at a company called Verif. Built a team up to a team of 5, supported 80 sellers globally. And we over $1 billion in value, 1.5, I think, valuation. So it was really, really great to support sellers across the globe. And now I'm taking the next leap and joining Jonathan as co-founder of the Practice Lab, where we can kind of solve that problem for how do we make those trainings stick and how do we change that perception of what training looks like.
Nice. And Jonathan, before we dive into the meat and potatoes, as they say, of the podcast, I know you've had a wild and varied past yourself, so why don't you give us a bit of an overview of how you got to where you are today?
Yeah, well, I feel like mine's a little bit less interesting than Lawrence's. Like many people, I got a degree that I couldn't get a job with, so I had to get into sales to pay the bills, right? And the idea was, oh, I'll just do sales short term. And then here we are, I don't know, 10, 12 years later, and I'm still doing sales. But what kind of sent me down this path here to co-founding the Practice Lab is that the whole time in sales, I've always had this like really, really voracious appetite for learning, right? Consumed lots of audiobooks, lots of podcasts, every training I attended, took copious notes, right? I was the Hermione Granger in the class. I just like loved learning and just like gobbled it up. However, in my real sales conversations, when I was in a demo and I had two or three different buyers, some of which were being kind of standoffish. I had six different things in my mind. I had my slide deck pulled up. I was noticing the time going by and money was on the line and the pressure was on. You know, son of a bitch, I just couldn't access those things that I had learned, right? It was like, where is all that knowledge I just learned? I can't really access it right now. In the moment when the pressure was on, that I had a buyer in front of me, just about the only thing I could access was my habits, those defaults that I'd been building up over years, those most deeply dug grooves in my brain. Those I could access, and that's what I ended up turning to almost every time. And I was just so frustrated at like how little of what I was learning was showing up in my calls. So I started looking outside the world of sales for answers and solutions to this, because I realized I was never going to be the seller I wanted to be if I had like a 2-5% transfer rate from what I learned to what I could do, right? It just wasn't going to happen. And I started reading books by these researchers who had spent decades, their entire career studying top performers, documenting how top performers get to the point where they can execute flawlessly under pressure better than anyone else in the world. And everywhere that I looked, whether it was, you know, sports, whether it was music, whether it was actors, comedians, chess players, the military, everywhere that I looked, I found the same answer. It wasn't about the theory. It wasn't about the knowledge. It was about the ability to consistently execute under pressure, which is really about skill, right? So skill versus knowledge is kind of the dichotomy that appeared. And I realized my whole sales career had just been focused on knowledge, helping me better understand, better comprehend, helping me know more about what good selling looked like and what I should be doing. But no attention had ever been paid to the level of skill that I had in my brain that I could execute under pressure. So in all these disciplines, the way the masters take the theory they have and turn it into something they can consistently do under pressure is through practice, and specifically deliberate practice. So I just got really excited and said, okay, this is my ticket. This is how I become the seller I want to be. And the earliest roots of the practice lab were just these like sessions I ran with my colleagues at my company when I was an AE, and we would practice together. And you know, eventually I opened it up to my LinkedIn network, and I brought in one co-founder a few years ago, Maya, who really helped to kind of take this nascent idea I had and turn it into a real solid product offering. And of course, now I'm partnering with Lawrence to kind of bring this thing to market. But that's really where it all started, is I was just getting frustrated kind of on the seller side with the same problem that Lawrence is getting frustrated with on the trainer side, which was that you train and no behaviors actually change. So we each kind of experience the same problem, but from different sides, and are now coming together to, you know, bring the solution to the sales world. So that's where I come, where how I got here.
Nice. Yeah, I think this is going to make for a really interesting conversation. And Lawrence and I actually caught up last week, and I think I kind of like my experience sort of straddles both of you. Like I got similar to Lawrence. I come from a sporty background, and the earliest parts of sport, they teach you like these skills, very like siloed, right? And that can work with a musical instrument because it's like a standalone thing, and it's, but the thing is as soon as you get to a sport, there's so many moving parts, so you can't just practice. You've got to practice within the setting. Like if you, for example, my sport is football or soccer, as North Americans call it. But if you were to practice like a 60-yard pass, right? So you do it 100 times, that's fine. But when you're in the game with someone breathing on you, the wind is going, the rain is going, it's a very different situation, right? So, interestingly, I use quite a lot of my own sporting background from coaching and playing in sales, and then now into sales enablement. So it's interesting, I kind of straddle both of that. So normally I start with a question. But today, what I fancied was, because it's something that we all run into, and I don't want to trigger you, Lawrence. I know that you've just probably finished this situation, but I want to present a problem to you, and it's going to probably trigger quite a few people who are listening. So let's just we're painting a picture of you're in enablement. You have put together a wonderful new program. Could be around new messaging, for example. Could be around executing on a new product. We've got these specific differentiators, so you put your session on. You run through the session, you've nailed it. There's been lots of engagement in the session. You've given them a one-pager to take away. You get them out there. You've spoken to the managers. The managers are going to reinforce, or they say they're going to reinforce, let's be honest, quote-unquote reinforce. But then you start going and listening to calls, and you start looking at some of the stats, and it's just not working. The needle hasn't moved. But you look back at your training program, and you go, look, we've given them this information. They should know this. They should do it, but they're just not, which is a situation that lots of enablement people find themselves in, and sales leaders, but more specifically enablement. If that was the problem that I was to present to you, how would deliberate practice help me solve that problem?
Yeah, I get chills just hearing you explain that situation because as enablers, we've all been in it, and it's just like the most frustrating feeling. When you think about practice, I look at practice as the bridge from knowing to doing, right? We talk about sports. You never sit and watch, like, Lionel Messi have an amazing match, and you think, you know what? If I were to get on the pitch tomorrow, I could do that. No one thinks that when they watch an amazing athlete. Even if you know how to kick a football and the plays of soccer and you've watched, or football, I forgot we're in the UK, and you know how to play and you know all those pieces, you could have watched, hours, tens of thousands of hours of football in your lifetime. You still never think that, oh, I could do that easily. So you can learn it and understand it, but you still know that you can't do it. And so that gap is having deliberate practice of saying, I actually have game-like reps. Like you said before, it's hard to have a rep that, or an environment that feels quite like the pressure of a sales call. But I know for me in sports, and it's the same way in deliberate practices, you want to make that environment even more high pressure, even more difficult, where you're pushed to failure even more than you would in a natural setting. So you feel in an actual call, this is actually easier than what I'm used to. So being able to create that environment where that idea can flourish is what it's all about. And I think right now we focus so much on the actual training event. And I see so many amazing enablers come up with amazing programs full of information and data and templates. But the environment that it lives in is not going to allow that to grow. It's the same as planting an amazing magnolia in the desert. Doesn't matter how good the plant is, it's not going to survive very long. So we've got to think not just about the event, but more so about the ecosystem that allows it to grow.
Yeah, I'd kind of add on top of that, that when you have a lack of behavior change, right? When you have this gap between what reps are doing and what you want them to do, generally speaking, there's three main reasons for that gap. One is it could be a knowledge gap. They actually don't know what they're supposed to be doing. And if it's a knowledge gap, traditional training, as has been done, is the perfect solution to that. And, typically that's where you start. However, everyone in enablement knows you can close that knowledge gap and people still don't change their behaviors. So then usually the explanation people default to is it's a motivation gap. They just don't care. They just don't want to. And honestly, sometimes that's true. But I can tell you that when I was a seller, I very much did want to. The motivation was there, but I still couldn't make it happen. And I think that's actually probably the case of many sellers, considering their commission is tied to their ability to execute. If you've done a good job with the training, most of your sellers are going to leave that training actually wanting to implement what you taught them. Most of the time. So generally, the real culprit is that skill gap, right? And as Lauren's mentioned, practice and deliberate practice specifically is the bridge between the theory and then the actual skill to pull it off. What your brain can handle under pressure, what your brain has available to it and can access in the moment. So it's not so much just about like, hey, here's a set of talking points, cover these things. It's about your brain's ability to read the situation, to respond to the situation, your brain's ability to recall what it learned even under pressure, and your brain's ability to implement what it learned under pressure. That's the skill piece. And from working with sales teams, it seems like that's honestly the culprit more often than not for when your sales teams aren't changing their behavior. It's because they have these deeply dug grooves, these deeply ingrained habits that under pressure, it's like that's all they can access, right? They literally can't access what you taught them. I don't want to go too deep here, but there is some brain science behind it where there's actual physiological changes in the brain to blood flow and oxygen levels under pressure that makes it difficult, if not impossible, to access your brain's library of knowledge and really focuses all your brain's resources on just turning to those defaults, those habits, those patterns. So the power of practice is that it can actually dig a new habit, dig a new groove in the brain right alongside that old one. That's actually accessible to people under pressure. So that's kind of how I would say that the value of practice there is digging that new groove, forming that new habit in your rep's brain so they at least have the option to access it under pressure.
No, I love that. And yeah, when you were talking about some of the research previously, it reminded me, I can't, for the life of me, I can't remember the name of the book. You may know it because it's very much within this field, but it's by a chap called Gary Klein. I think it's like The Power of Decision or something like that. And I think literally the first chapter is about like firefighters who are like under, they're fighting fires. And it goes like right back to what you just mentioned there is under the most extreme of pressure, you go back to your most common habits. Right, so if your most common, if you don't change those habits or you don't like reroute those or recirculate those, you will consistently go back to those, and it sort of went into like flow state, and that's what flow state, when we talk about flow state, it's because it's a pattern of doing this, all these small consistent decisions time after time after time, but it takes such a long time to get there, and it takes such a long time to undo those, right? Because you're so ingrained. Going back to Messi, you know, when you put him in a situation, he's been in that situation so many times because it's very deliberate that he can do it. I'm going to be very honest with you, right? Jonathan and I spoke a while ago about Practice Labs. And I even had a conversation on this podcast with a chap called Coach K, Jonathan Carford. And he was like, he hates role plays, right? He said he hates role plays. And I was like, what do you mean? I'm more than happy to look foolish, right? But when someone come to, the first time I heard about it, someone went, deliberate practice, that's just practice, right? It just is what it is, right? You can call it deliberate, you can say it's different, but it sounds like it actually is different. So, like, for anyone out there who's like going, well, that sounds like I'm doing already, it sounds like what I'm doing already, how would you differentiate between those training events, maybe the breakout rooms, which is the practice, and then this deliberate practice that you guys are really focused on, that you feel makes the real difference?
Okay, so
Lawrence, Jonathan, I feel like with your background in sports and music. yeah.
I'm going to tee you up for this one because you've got some good information on role plays, but I know a lot of the refs that I talk to absolutely hate role plays, and it's for a couple of reasons. One is it's not game-like. And I know a lot of sellers who are great at doing role plays and not that great when it comes to an actual call. And then also I know sellers who are not that great in role plays but perform really well under pressure. I heard Jonathan use this analogy the other day, and so I'm going to steal a little bit of your thunder, but I've been driving for, I don't know, almost 20 years now. Usually they say you need 10,000 hours to be an expert at something. I could not go and drive Formula One right now. That's because the time that I spend driving, it's not intentional. It's just, I'm just doing it. My mind is somewhere else. I'm listening to music. I'm having a conversation. It's not deliberate practice on how can I get better. I'm not pushing the limits of my driving skills. So there's a big difference between practice and deliberate practice. And the reason a lot of companies get it messed up is because you will see improvement with practice. You will see a small amount of improvement, but deliberate practice, it's going to be 10 times more. And so a lot of the benefits of just 20 hours of deliberate practice is going to get you further than a year's worth of just doing something without actually having your mind into it. And I think in role plays, a lot of times it's easy to kind of understand where they're going. So it's almost like memorizing a book as a 5-year-old and pretending you know how to read. You know, yeah. I know what's going to happen. I know what this should feel like. So it's very easy. And so, and also in the environment, it's not really a safe place to fail for sellers because you want to get up in front of your team and not look stupid. You want to prove to your manager or your VP that you're very well versed in all the information and you know how to sell and you don't need any help. When in reality, real practice is, I want to make this more difficult than it normally would be. So how do I push you? How do I throw some curveballs in there? And that depends on how good the buyer is. So, Jonathan, there's one other point about kind of chunking down and some other things. So I'm going to kick it to you to talk about that. But for me, the biggest thing is like, how do I actually make it so that I have to be reactive in that moment versus just knowing what's going to come?
Yeah, no, the number one problem with traditional role play, the way it's done, is exactly what Lawrence mentioned, that you end up with a bunch of sellers at the end of it who become masters at role play, who are really only marginally better at selling, because the environment of a role play is different than a real sales call. The way your practice partner, who's like steeped in the same company knowledge you're steeped in, the way they respond to your questions is very different than the way a real buyer responds to your questions. So you can be to a point where you can, like, you know, twist people up in knots and get them right where you want them in a role play. And then dang, you get on a call with a real buyer and suddenly they don't behave the same way your practice partner behaved. And suddenly you actually can't work this scenario. I like using the analogy of, imagine if you have like a flight simulator for a pilot, but in the flight simulator, the weight of the plane, the density of air, and the force of gravity are actually different than they are in the real world. That pilot can learn how to fly that plane under those conditions, but then they get in a real plane and suddenly, you know, air and gravity and all that is different, and they fall apart and they crash the plane because, again, the environment is so different. So that's the number one problem with role play. And honestly, I think that's the reason why sales as an industry doesn't use it as a tool more, because most people who use it experience some early, quick lifts from doing it, But then it just like peters out and it plateaus and they don't see themselves getting any better. They could keep doing role plays every week for a year and they don't get a whole lot better after that first like couple of months. And it's because, again, there's that difference in the environment. So to solve that, there's two things to look at. One is exactly how the practice is structured. Even the subtlest details make a big difference. The other two is the environment that it's done in. And Lawrence touched on this, right? This is one of the reasons why sellers hate role play usually, because it's so awkward. It's so uncomfortable. And the reason it's so awkward and so uncomfortable is because in most role plays, it's positioned as a really high-pressure environment where the purpose is to prove you can do it. Prove to your colleagues who are on the other side of the room that you can do it. Prove to your manager that you can do it. Hell, sometimes companies will even position role play as a certification, where it's like, you have to do this to pass, to prove you can do your job, and then we'll let you go on. And what's interesting is when the brain is in that kind of environment, it doesn't actually learn or grow or get any better. That's the performance mode. And when you're in the performance mode, all your brain focuses on is doing the very best you can do in this moment. Your brain doesn't have the freedom and flexibility to try something new on, to try choosing a different path, to try digging a new groove in the brain. In the performance mode, all your brain does is it turns to that most reliable, most deeply dug behavior it has, and it uses that. Great analogy of this. I was talking to someone one time who was a volleyball player, and they even worded it really well, where they said, you know, there was a time in their career where they'd gotten pretty good at serving, and then their coach taught them a jump serve. And then the very next day, they had a competition, and they didn't use that jump serve because that's performance mode. When you're in a competition, you're in performance mode. You're not learning new things. You're not trying new things. You're turning to what you already are good at. So when you have people practice in the performance mode, what's really happening is you're just solidifying whatever their current level of best is. You're not actually giving them a chance to get better, to try new things, to break new ground, to dig new grooves. So that's the environmental piece. If you put people in a role play where the expectation is prove to me you can do it, then no one's going to grow any skill. It's a great assessment. It's a great way to tell where your reps are at, but no one's actually going to grow any skill. You could have them do that once a week for a year and they'd never get better. They would just further solidify whatever their current best is. So to do deliberate practice, you need to be in the improvement zone where the pressure is off a little bit. No one's assessing you, judging you. You're not trying to impress anyone. The purpose of the improvement zone is to give your brain the chance to try something new on, to stumble and mess up, to, you know, try handling things differently, make new choices, dig new grooves. And there needs to be a certain level of psychological safety for that to happen. And we found in practice that once you add in that psychological safety layer, most reps actually stop hating role play. Just by giving them psychological safety. The other piece, though, is still has to be dealt with, which is you could become a master at role play and still not great in the real world. And that's where the structure comes into play. I don't want to go too deep on this, but just some high-level points here. For practice to be deliberate, you have to be clear going into it on exactly what good looks like, right? It's not a scenario where you say, okay, I'll hit you with an objection, and you give it your best shot, respond. That's not going to help. You need to clarify in advance, here's what good looks like. Here's what an effective response includes. Here's a framework. Here's a pattern. Here's a few bullet points you want to make sure you hit. Get clear going in what good looks like. And then when you're done, when you've done the repetition, you need to get clear on exactly how your performance measured up to those standards and figure out exactly where the room for improvement is. And then you need to have a chance to go back into practice again to try it again. All too often in role plays, you'll get up there, you'll do your thing, your manager will hit you with a laundry list of 6 pieces of feedback, then you'll sit down, it's the next person's turn. Again, great assessment, but no skill grows. For skill to grow, you have to have this like rapid back and forth of try it, get some feedback, implement the feedback, get some more feedback, implement that, get some more. And in order to practice in that way, the other element of deliberate practice, which is hugely important, is that you have to really chunk things down. In order for your brain to make new choices, to dig new grooves, you need to be focusing on just one thing at a time. Your brain can't handle trying something completely new in 6 different areas all at once. So you can't say, hey folks, we're going to role play a discovery call and role play the whole thing. Neither can you say, hey folks, we're going to role play, I don't know, objection handling, and here's like 6 elements of what makes for a good response. Make sure, you know, you're good on all 6 points. You got to roll it out one layer at a time. Focus on one moment first, get that moment good. Focus on one layer first, get that layer good. So to provide some examples of this, this kind of chunking down approach, at the practice lab, when we have people practice their demos, we don't have them practice the whole demo. We just pick key moments in those demos that carry a lot of weight in how the conversation goes, and we have them practice with those moments. So one example of this is we found a really powerful moment in a demo is after a rep has shown a feature of their product, what do most reps do? Either A, they just move right along and show the next feature, or B, they'll say, any questions? And then they'll move on. that's not a very good way to handle that moment. We train people and have people practice handling that moment differently so that when that moment comes around, they've shown the feature, they pause. They hand the microphone to their buyer, and they get the buyer reflecting on what they just saw. They get their buyer talking about how they would use what they just saw, what the value they see in what they just saw, and ultimately how that value connects to and maps back to their organization's highest level priorities. That's a really powerful moment, right? If you can nail that moment, your buyer leaves with a really strong business case and a really strong feeling in their gut that, hell yes, we should do this. If you don't handle that moment well, they typically leave the demo feeling like, oh, that was a cool product, but not all that excited to make a change. So that's one version of chunking down, is pick a moment. The other version of chunking down, though, is to just pick a certain element or dimension of performance. So for example, a lot of people agree that the best salespeople are the best listeners. Well, you can actually do practice where people practice nothing but their listening skills. You don't assess them or grade them on any other aspect of what good performance looks like. You don't care what topics they cover. You don't care if their questions are open or closed-ended. You don't care if they have a good tone of voice or not. You don't care about any of that. All you care about is their listening. And you put them in an exercise and they just focus on their listening, and they do that so often that this new way of deeper listening becomes their default, becomes a new deeply dug groove, and becomes easy for them to do. Once they've got the listening piece, then you roll out the next layer, right? Maybe the next layer is curiosity and training their brain to get curious, and then you focus on training that. Then maybe the next layer is you train their brain on coming up with questions on the fly, right? Because, of course, there's a certain mental skill to be able to take this little itch you have of, ooh, I'd like to know more about that, and instantly turn it into a really good, thought-provoking, you know, direct but not too direct type question. That's a real mental skill. So you can focus on one chunk at a time. And if you include all these elements of like chunking it down, breaking it down into layers, clear in advance what good looks like, rapid feedback in the middle, then you have this environment which creates this deliberate style practice where, unlike Lawrence driving his car, where he does it every single day but never gets much better at it, you suddenly have this environment where with that extra intention and awareness and focus, the brain can actually start to make new choices, start to dig new grooves, start to create new habits, patterns, and defaults so that you can get into that flow state, right, where you can just do all this stuff effortlessly without thinking about it. But like you earn the right to get into the flow state, and you earn the ability to get into the flow state through hours and hours of repetition and practice in advance to dig these new grooves in your brain through deliberate practice. So that may have been the longest monologue I've ever done on a single podcast. I'm going to take a breather now. Lawrence, the next one's on you, buddy.
I think there was so much. I think people will have to re-listen to that. There's so many good messages. I mean, I think even starting from the start, like the original practicing until you get it right. Lawrence and I had a very similar conversation last week, like in enablement. Because of lots of for a variety of different reasons, we practice until people get things right rather than practice it until they don't get it wrong. And there's a massive difference, and that sounds like the same thing, but it really isn't, right? The outcome is vastly different, and we have these pressures. And so, and to your point around certifications, I've used certifications with a role play at the end a number of times, and I think in speaking from a personal point of view, I've seen people turn up in all manner of different mental states for those. I've had people be happy to do it. People don't care. People get upset because they put so much pressure on themselves, and they really want to pass, and they don't want to look bad. And even if we know it's not life or death and all these different things. So that psychological safety that you mentioned really seems to be missing with a lot of role plays. And I think the thing is when I enjoy using some form of role play as a certification, but the problem is, to your point, if I use it as a certification at the end of onboarding, it's just it's a passing out where it's, I need you to hit this minimum level or we go back the way. But the problem is the minimum level is only good if it then gets reinforced afterwards by us or by managers or by whomever. But quite often that's the end, right? And then you might get, and my other thing that you picked up on as well is with certifications or role plays, you just get feedback. You don't get coaching, right? And again, I've probably been on my soapbox about this so many times. I've done a couple of sessions with the Sales Enablement Collective on the difference between feedback and coaching. And for my definition, is a feedback is an opinion on something that's already happened. Coaching is unlocking potential future performance through asking questions, through whatever it may be. And 99 times out of 100, if you were to think of the role plays you've been involved in, or the ones that you've ran, like if we talk about the traditional role play, you just give feedback. It's very difficult to give feedback and coach all in the same session. So to your point, nothing changes, right? Nothing ever changes. And there's other ways that you can obviously massage that. However, it's really difficult. And I think to what the, one of the other things that I picked up on there is like changing these old grooves, and it made me sort of smile because I do like fitness racing for my, I'm getting old, I need to feel important, so I do like fitness competitions, and I was trying out a new technique for walking lunges the other day. Right, I've been going to the gym for a long time in my life. If you ask me, do I know how to do a walking lunge? Absolutely, I do. But what I take, so normally I just walk right through. So then I've got some advice on like the way to do this faster is you do a lunge and then you take a step. So you bring your feet together and then you go, so you go alternate legs. And you would have think I didn't even know how to walk, right? And I've been like, and literally all I had to do was put one foot together, do right foot, bring it up, stop, left foot, bring it up, right foot. I couldn't do it, right? So it fits in with your point, right? Where it's like, it was the tiniest change. So rather than me just go consistently through, I did a tiny change, which actually helps me, like genuinely helps you not burn out the same. However, it was like I was Bambi on ice, right? Like my legs were all over the place. I would do like two right leg, one left leg, two left, you know, like I was all over. I'm sure I'll get it with practice, but it's got to be deliberate, and I know why I'm doing it, and I know what the outcome is, and I need to get feedback on it. So I think this deliberate practice is, it's apparent in all walks of life, right? So
now just imagine how much harder that would be, Kieran, if like your ability to pay your mortgage depended on your ability to do that and execute well. Imagine if you knew it was being recorded and analyzed by your superiors, right? Like add the pressure element and it's even harder to break out of those default grooves. Yeah.
Yeah. Someone said, take a video of you doing that and send it. It would never see the light of day. It would be one of the funniest things of all time, right? So, but I also, even the consistent element that you talk about, I've gone back on this, and even like with enablement and saying it in reps, I'm like, is it, for, I went back, my analogy is a gym analogy, is like, what do you think is better for you getting better, for you improving? Going to the gym for 9 hours in one day, or going for 1 hour 9 days in a row, right? But that sounds like people say you would never go for 9 days, 9 hours in one day. But that's what we do with a lot of enablement programs, right? We'll get you for half a day. We'll absolutely batter you with information. And then we'll go, okay, go now. Rather than, like to your point, chunk it down. Rather than phase it through and put all these things together. So I'm going to ask the question that anyone listening to that fantastic answer you gave is going to, anyone in enablement is probably going to be thinking the same thing as I'm thinking. Sounds great. Sounds lovely. Sounds fantastic, even. I don't have time. I don't have time. I need to get this program out. I need to... I don't know. Am I responsible for the coaching? Is the manager responsible for the coaching? So how would I operate? Like, let's just say, obviously, you guys, this is something we're going to get on to what how the Practice Lab can help enablers and other businesses. But put yourself in an enablement shoes. How could you operationalize this as part of a current program if we have enablers just currently building a program? How could we take this deliberate practice, operationalize it, and sort of A/B test against what they're currently doing?
Ooh. Okay, so I'm going to try to be as straight to the point as possible. I think there's probably three things I would want to do. First, I would want to look at the behaviors that influence winning. What I mean by that, I'm not talking about lagging indicator, win rate, or even leading indicator, sales stage progression. I'm thinking, how many contacts are engaged on every opportunity? Or what's the average talk to listen time on every demo call? Or what's the average discount price on all of my opportunities, of closed won opportunities? Those are specific behaviors that I can very clearly show that enablement is influenced. So that has to do with like skills and very tactical behaviors. Then I want to look at what are the outputs of the sales team. So things like mutual action plans, business cases, you might have your notes in Salesforce, those kinds of things. How can we make those better? What are those outputs and what collateral do we have across the org, from product marketing to sellers, things that our sellers are making on their own? How can we organize all those for those specific, around that specific purpose? And then the third thing is going to be, if you use a conversation intelligence tool, how can I put together, I'm not even going to address the idea that managers don't have time to coach, but what I will say is it's a lot to go through Gong videos and watch every single call. When I was running my enablement team, I've had my team watching calls every day, but I would set up some specific smart trackers on things like, how many times did the prospect laugh during the call? How engaged was each person on that call? What was the talk time? just setting up some smart trackers, what happened when there was an objection that was given, longest pause in a call, just certain things to see how engaged people were on a call, and then feed that information to the sales manager and say, hey, here's some coaching opportunities that you might be able to have to bring up in your next one-to-one.
It's a very good question to ask, Kieran. And my answer might not be as helpful or as encouraging, but maybe realistic, which is that I think to adopt a deliberate practice, you do have to accept that less is going to be covered. There is no way to like dig deeply dug grooves in people's brain at the same pace you used to dump information into the front of their head, right? Those two things just don't happen at the same pace. So if you want new habits, new deeply dug grooves, new defaults, it is absolutely going to take more time than the time it takes to fill their heads with knowledge. And you just have to accept that. And you have to say, you know what? Rather than teaching them everything about good selling from prospecting through discovery through demo through negotiation in the space of 3 months, maybe we just pick one of those. Because the reality is, if you try to do everything all at once, you generally get zero behavior change anywhere. In which case, 3 months have elapsed and the team is no better off than they used to be. Better to pick one thing, actually change the behavior so that in 3 months' time the team is actually better off, at least in one regard. But you do have to slow down, which unfortunately in the world of enablement means you need to get your sales leaders to agree to slow down, right? You need to go back to your CEO and say, yeah, I know you want this entire methodology rolled out in the next 3 months, but no, it can't happen, right? Maybe we can cover prospecting in the next 3 months, but the rest of it's going to have to wait. And that is a tough conversation, and I don't envy anyone in enablement who has those kind of like impatient, delusional leaders who think they can just like give you a laundry list of things. You can spin up a training and then boom, you know, problem solved, behavior changed. Send them this episode in this case. We'll set them straight if you got those leaders. But you do have to slow down for sure.
No, I get that. Interestingly, I'm in a situation right now which is somewhere I've never found myself before, and that we are actually going backwards. So we rolled out a methodology as a business last year, November of last year, and it wasn't, we did it one way, and it wasn't particularly overly adopted for a variety of different reasons. We changed lots of things at the same time. However, to your point, we're actually going backwards, and we're focusing specifically on one metric. We're focusing specifically on three different, no more than three different elements of the qualification calls. Same for AEs, so everyone's got a different metric. And again, it's all to go backwards, because what we're going to do before that is pile on top. And it's like, well, if your foundation is not particularly good, why are you putting more on, right? So I think there is that sort of tipping point, and that is a difficult conversation, to your point, right? To be able to say, like, I know that you really want to push this out. However, if you look at where we're at right now, there's no point in doing that. So you've got, I mean, it's, sometimes you've got to be brave. Sometimes you've got to be brave, right? And that's a special type of bravery to go to your CRO or your CEO and be like, listen, I know that you want it, but tough. So guys, I'm just conscious that we're almost at time. So I'd like to ask you for, you can do one each or you can both do one, but I normally finish each episode with one practical tip and one tactical tip for anyone who's looking, any enablers who are looking to implement or use deliberate practice. So I'll leave the split up to you guys, but one practical and one tactical tip.
Okay, I'm going to start with the easier, I guess, practical. Yeah. Which one is more high level? I'm going to go there. I don't know the difference between practical and tactical. I feel like they're both quite in the weeds. But anyway, I think something that I hold to and that I think Jonathan does a good job of kind of expressing and fleshing out is direction over speed. So when you're actually practicing or working on a skill, you want to be focused on, is this right before you try to get it at game speed? And before you try to integrate it into everything else that you're doing. So if you're talking about how you handle an objection, let's just handle that one moment after someone delivers an objection. And if it feels a little bit weird, like you trying to do lunges in the gym, slow it down. Slow it down as much as you need to until you get it to where you feel good about it, and then work on your speed. So you can whittle that down to like very micro in terms of practice, or even to the macro in terms of your enablement function and how you run things. Let's get things moving in the right direction. Let's focus on 1 to 3 key behaviors, no more, and get us moving directionally correct before we try to throw gasoline on that fire. So direction over speed for me is a really big one.
Great. Love it.
I like that. That's beautiful. I think mine probably fits in the world of tactical. So while we just talked at length about how to do role plays well, the reality is even us who have been doing this for 3 years have found there are some real inherent limitations to role play. right? That can only take you so far. So in our program, we've developed four different types of practice that we can turn to help grow skill. So I'll just share one of those here as my tactical tip, which is that rather than using a practice partner as the one to like feed you prompts and feed your brain inputs to decide what to do with and how to react to, you can actually use recordings of real conversations to feed your reps' brains inputs and scenarios and information to give their brain a chance to wrestle with what they just heard and make decisions and choices about how to handle it, right? In which case, you've bypassed the it's not realistic issue because it's as realistic as it gets. It's a real-ass call. And in order to do this effectively, you need to stop thinking of call review as your chance to like play the clip for a while, pause, share your ideas, reflect on what you just heard, rate how the seller did, talk about how you would have handled it. That's a really great exercise in awareness, and it's worth doing for sure, but it doesn't actually like train people's brains to be better, you know, at thinking quickly under pressure or anything. So the tactical tip is this: when you're doing call reviews, rather than always just pausing and looking back at what you've heard and discussing the theory behind it all, when you're going through your call reviews, pause the tape right after the buyer's done talking and immediately have everyone else in the room, whether it's a one-on-one conversation with a rep or whether it's a group or your whole team is involved in, have everyone share with you or throw in the chat, what would you say next if you were the buyer? Like, actually take this input, right? Take what the buyer just said. Think about it. Listen to it. Understand it. Think about the options you have in your mind of where you could take the conversation from here. Choose a path and then spit out a question that'll redirect the conversation in that direction. That mental process of taking in what the buyer is saying, thinking it over, making some choices, spitting out a question, that's the exact maneuver your brain has to do in a real sales call. And that's one of the most difficult maneuvers to do in sales. So you can actually use a recording as a way to train your brain's rep. Your reps' brains, and it's a different form of practice. So the tactical tip is when you hit pause, don't look back at what just happened. When you hit pause on that tape, look forward at what's going to happen next and make everyone share with you what they would do next if they were the rep. Then you'll be tapping into one of the four forms of practice that we've developed, and it can be quite effective for helping reps grow skill.
Lovely. I'd like to wrap this. I think those were two great tips. Fantastic. I'd love to for you guys to wrap up with a bit of an elevator pitch on the practice labs, how you believe you could be an effective partner with lots of enablement or sales organizations, and then just give me a bit of an overview of where we can find you if people want to connect, and then we can wrap up from there.
Yeah, so you think it'd be, you think I'd be better at this. Let's see. So you already have the context for what we're all about. We're all about changing behaviors. To your point, though, Kieran, it's really freaking difficult to do this and to do it well. While it took me no time to say it, the process of actually identifying what the most important moments are and then identifying what exactly good looks like in those moments in a really tactical way, right? Not just a descriptive way. It's not enough to tell people, hey, when you hear an objection, don't get combative. Try to go for more of a collaborative vibe. While that's a great description, that's not actionable. They don't know exactly what they need to do to achieve that collaborative vibe, right? So breaking it down to the key moments that matter most, figuring out exactly what good looks like in a tactical way, and then figuring out what are like the different layers of performance and like what order should you tackle them in, right? So again, maybe one time you focus on the words that they're saying, and one time you focus on their tone of voice, and the other time you focus on their ability to listen, and the other time they focus on their ability to handle curveballs. Like, there's just different layers to performance, and you can't get them all right. So to really get extra level performance, you need to lay them out one at a time. And then you need to design exercises that more closely resemble the real world so that, again, you end up with people who aren't just, you know, role play experts, but really better in sales calls. And all of that stuff actually takes a lot of time. So our value prop to the world is that we've already done that. We spent 3 years figuring this out, reading every book there is on performance and deliberate practice, tinkering, testing, trying, getting feedback. Every exercise that we have right now is on like, you know, V6 or V10 right now. So our value prop of the world is if you want this kind of practice in your team and you don't have the next 2 years of your life to dedicate to figuring out how to do it well, you can hire us. We've already figured out how to do it well. We can show up, run these sessions with your team, and then also equip you and your managers with the resources you need to create that environment Lawrence was talking about earlier, so that after we leave, it doesn't just disappear. It isn't that magnolia tree in the desert. After we leave, this thing actually grows and thrives and continues to produce. We can leave behind all those resources for your managers, for your individual reps, for your, you know, yourself as an enabler. So we've got it all figured out. We can make it quite easy and kind of plug and play. So if any of that sounds interesting, you can find us at thepracticelab.co. That's our website. If you want to have a conversation with us and explore bringing practice to your team, you can email us hello at thepracticelab.co. But we also put something together, Kieran. We're actually just wrapping it up this week, but we put something together for your listeners. So one of our exercises, one of our most popular exercises, is around objection handling. And it's an exercise that, of course, uses deliberate practice to dig new grooves in your reps' brains so that under pressure, they can access this new behavior. And what we're teaching them is this framework for responding to objections in a way that actually does lower the buyer's defenses. It gets them to open up their mind to considering new possibilities. It creates that collaborative vibe that I just mentioned a moment ago. And ultimately, it just buys you the time to keep the deal alive long enough to learn, to think, to plan, and ultimately see, you know, collaboratively with your buyer, figure out if there's a way to move past it or not. This exercise is something that we've actually just bundled up in a like do-it-yourself digital kit, kind of a practice-in-the-box type thing, where if you'd like, with like 30 minutes prep time max, you can actually run this deliberate practice session for your team. And of course, it already has all the work done in figuring out, you know, the different layers of complexity and how to lay it out and what good looks like. It's already got that figured out. All you have to do is bring your team together in a room, watch some videos, have some group discussions, put people in breakout rooms, and you can actually recreate the experience as if we were there when we're not even there to run it. So for anybody who wants to try out this deliberate practice thing with their team at no cost, you can actually email us and we'll send you that digital kit so you can run this objection handling booster with your team. Obviously, being end of year, this is kind of objection season for a lot of teams out there right now. A lot of the revenue they're counting on for the end of the year is going to have to get through a few objections before they get to close. So this is your chance to sharpen your rep skills in the area of objections before, you know, end of year and objection season starts up fully. So email us at hello@thepracticelab.co, mention this podcast, and we will send you that blueprint at no cost. And you can run this deliberate practice session with your team for yourself and see how you like it.
Wonderful. Well, chaps, a hell of a first episode back. I might need another rest after this. Thanks a lot for coming on, and thanks everyone for listening to another episode of Enablement Evolved. See you all soon.
Thanks, Kieran. Take